Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming. It's going to be a great evening, I can tell you that. I was saying to some people who were looking after me when I arrived that there are economists have something called rational expectations. I said, I know that Tariq would be late. I know that because that's the model. The model predicts. And secondly, the model predicts you're going to have a great time. I can talk about for an hour about Tariq. I'm not going to. I will tell you one story, which I think Tariq himself doesn't know. About 42 years ago, in 1960, the great days of 1968, LSE Student Rebellion, which some of you may have heard of, this old theater was not as beautiful and nicely designed as it is right now, but it was very, 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 very kind of central focus of the rebellion. And this hall used to be completely and utterly crowded. And Tariq was about to speak. And I had heard, I was at that time for some reasons which are very obscure, the honorary president of the LSE Students Union. I had heard that the Hemel Hempstead Maoists were going to attack Tariq physically, right? And knowing Tariq, I knew that if he knew that, he would provoke the attack. So we had a very delicate task of not telling Tariq he was going to be attacked and making quite sure that if anybody attacked Tariq, we'd beat him up. So without his knowing, around him, I had arranged a group of very tough-looking students. And I told them, listen, you don't listen to Tariq. Don't get lost in that. Look out everywhere. If anybody who advances toward the stage, just jump on them. Anyway, I'm glad to say we protected Tariq without his knowing. And I always wanted to tell him that story, but never got to. Anyway, Tariq Ali is one of, I think it's a national treasure, which will embarrass him. But he also is a superb speaker. And for as many years as I have known him, I have veered all over the place ideologically, and he has been absolutely true to himself. He has been one of our leading left thinkers and internationalist. He has kept track of, as it were, rebellion across the world. He has always been monitoring, observing, analyzing, criticizing people in revolt against regimes have behaved, have created things, have fallen apart, the whole dynamics of that. And he has been writing for many years. He's part of one of the finest achievements of British thinking, the New Left Review, and I believe that sincerely there are very few things like the New Left Review existing in the whole world, and he has been part of that. And lately, the biggest surprise, Tariq is a novelist. I never thought he'd do that, but he has managed to write five across a large span of time, and he's going to talk about that. But I'm sure he could talk about much more than that. So I'm not going to stand between you and Tariq. And Tariq.
Thanks very much, Meghnad, for that kind introduction. I was wondering, as you were talking, what happened to those Hemel Hempstead Maoists? And I wouldn't be totally surprised if some of them joined the Conservative Party and the others became New Labour apparatchiks and a few ended up as stockbrokers. I mean, I'm not totally joking, because when I travel around the country, often people come up and say, hi, you don't remember me, but I remember you. So I said, this is boring, whether I remember you or not, tell me what you were then and what you are now. And there's usually a slight embarrassment. And the last time it happened was in Brighton. Someone said, I was at the LSE in the 60s and used to hear you speak. And he was incredibly well-dressed. So I said, what are you now? He said, a stockbroker. I said, are you doing well? And he said, yeah, I've done quite well. Financial speculation this is what he'd become. So, you know, people change, generations shift, life goes on and the world goes on, though it's a very different world than the one Meknad and I grew up in. And I feel a great deal for young people who are at university today. It's not the same. The priorities are different, the world is different, and we live in a time where, even as we speak, some things, tiny things, are happening. The students at Middlesex University have occupied the university, but it's a very short-term thing. But the reason they've occupied it is very interesting, because the university authorities have decided to disband the entire philosophy department. That is now known as education. And the reason they said they had disbanded the philosophy department was that it wasn't cost-effective. It wasn't making them enough money. Who in their right minds ever thought that philosophy was going to make anyone money? I mean, you have to be nutty, even if you're a highly paid management consultant. These are the people who are very dominant in the university structures to raise money, if you think philosophy is going to raise money. Philosophy is not about that. It's about something else. It's about trying to understand who we are, the world we live, how ideas develop, what language is. In fact, just before, the reason I was late, Menna, that I was on the phone to a professor or philosopher at Middlesex, Peter Holwood, trying to fix up when I would go and speak to the Middlesex students either this weekend or early next week, and the phone call went on till finally I had to get away. But anyway, this talk isn't about that. It's about a set of novels I've been writing since 1991, known as the Islam Quintet, which have finally concluded with the publication of The Night of the Golden Butterfly. And these novels were an attempt. I mean, they started off originally, I thought I would write one novel, and then that novel was Shadows of the Pomegranate Tree, about life in Spain in the 15th and 16th centuries. And the creation, not that the novel is about that, but to contextualize it, the creation of the modern European identity as a monocultural culture, which began with the expulsion of the Muslims and the Jews from Spain in the 15th and 16th centuries. And it was a very deliberate decision. And by the end of the 17th century, there were no Muslims left in Europe, because what they were offered, the choice they were offered, was Jews and Muslims, convert or leave. And most of them, or at least we don't know most, but certainly half of them left Europe. And they went to the Maghreb, and they went to the Ottoman lands. And a group of Jews on a boat actually landed up in what is now the Indian state of Kerala, in Cochin, and the Maharaja there gave them asylum for perpetuity, and they built one of the most beautiful synagogues. So that was the world that was being destroyed in Europe, and this interested me, especially at that time when the communist world had collapsed with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Soviet Union was in a state of disintegration, and the first Gulf War was taking place. And people were talking a lot of nonsense about what Arabs are, what Arab culture is, and what it isn't. And at that time, I felt the urge, which I had never felt before, to try and unravel the history of Islam in Europe, because most people didn't even know that Islam was once a major European religion. And that is when I went to Spain, thinking that I would be writing a long essay or a little book. And then when I saw the monuments, especially in Granada and Cordoba and Sevilla, I thought the best way to deal with this was to try and recover that civilization fictionally, analyze its last days. What happened to these guys and gals? And where were they? Why did they lose? What was it? So I wrote Shadows of the Pomegranate Tree, and it was reasonably successful, very much so in Spain, where people told me we had no idea this was our history. Because on the school books, the school textbooks, we were taught a paragraph. There was one paragraph about 600 years of Spanish history. The Arabs came, the Catholics threw them out. Which is one way of doing history. And so many people would see the monuments and wonder, saying, oh, this must have been from that period, but not know what had happened. And I was very touched by that tour I did of Spain, because the number of young people and older people who came up and said to me, they just said, thanks for writing it. We had no idea. And when I said this, told my friend, the late Palestinian writer and scholar Edward Said about this, he just said, it's now your duty to write the whole bloody story. You can't stop now. I don't care what else you're doing. You have to just sit down and write the story of the clash between Islamic civilization and Western Christendom, was how he put it. And it was not accidental that he framed it in that particular way. So the novels then slowly started happening. The second novel was a novel about Saladin, who some of you may have heard of, who was the Kurdish leader of the Arab world and one of the few people who managed to unite the Arab world against outside aggressors. And he did it, and he organized in his armies all the different ethnic groups of Muslims, most interestingly enough, of the native Arab Christians and all the Jews. They were a minority, but it really was a multicultural army that Saladin assembled to defeat the Crusaders and take back Jerusalem in the 12th century, which he did. And he did more than that. He insisted that, which for that time actually shook quite a lot of Christian chroniclers who'd gone with the armies, that he said that there could not be any revenge killings. There were to be no massacres, no rapes once Jerusalem was taken, no burning down of churches, no desecration. He said Jerusalem has to be a city for all the people of the book, by which he meant Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And state subsidies were provided by Saladin to rebuild all the synagogues that had been burnt down in that city, and some of the mosques. So that is a story worth telling for all sorts of reasons. A, because not many people know these stories, but second, also they have some resonance today in the world in which we live. And often in the Arab world, when I'm introducing these novels, which are quite popular there, people say, yeah, we like the Book of Saladin, but explain to us why you made the guy to whom he's dictating his memoirs a Jewish scribe, because they see it purely from the point of view of today. This couldn't happen today. And so then one says that essentially what you had in large parts of the world before they were expelled from Europe was an Islamo-Judaic civilization. This was also the case in the Arab world, where Islam actually protected the Jewish population. Most of the pogroms and killings of Jews that took place historically over thousands of years were not carried out by Islam. And it's a point worth making, because very few Israelis make it today. One wonders why. But they don't. though they know perfectly well that's true. I mean, 80% of Saladin's advisors, including his personal physician, were Jews. And it was normal. There's nothing abnormal about it. So all these things go into my books in some shape or form, precisely to make people think. Because the one thing I try and avoid doing is writing to please, whether it's fiction or non-fiction. You know, you have to sort of lay it out, and if people don't like it, they don't like it. It doesn't bother me. Or if a book isn't praised, it doesn't bother me at all. In fact, what sometimes bothers me is if too many people praise my work. I then wonder what I've done wrong. That it hasn't created some controversy. And one should never really write to please. So after the book of Saladin, I confronted the third big question, if you like. Why didn't the Ottoman Empire modernize? After all, this was situated right next to Europe. It was the most powerful empire we have seen. It's the longest living empire we'd seen. You know, it began in the 16th century, or even before, if you look at it one way, and ended in the 20th century. So a continuous period of rule by the Ottomans, and yet they failed. They failed to modernize their country when they were absolutely next to Europe, where some of these developments were taking place. I mean, that's not the theme of the book, but it appears in the book. A family, the disintegration of a family in a house outside Istanbul, which mirrors the disintegration of the society and the empire which is taking place. That was the third novel, called The Stone Woman. And the fourth novel was A Sultan in Palermo, where, to be perfectly frank with you, I had no idea of writing a novel on Sicily. But many Italian friends wrote me and said, you know, how come you've not written about Sicily? And I said it wasn't important enough. And there was a big heated debate with some of my Italian friends. And they said, go and see whether, and go and talk, because very little is written on the Arab period in Sicily, apart from a six-volume history by Michele Amari, a great Sicilian historian written in the 19th century, which I can't read Italian. So, you know, having these six volumes in my house was sort of agonizing, but then I started with using a dictionary, and then an Egyptian friend who was translating these books into Arabic for the first time sat with me and said, what do you want out of these books? So we discussed it. And she was incredibly helpful. And then I went and spent 2 months in Sicily, just smelling the island, talking to people, seeing, because there are not many ruins left, not mainly because they were destroyed, though quite a few were destroyed, but you know, the Arab city of Noto in Sicily was not destroyed by Christians, it was destroyed by an earthquake. And by the time they rebuilt the city, the Normans had taken over Sicily, so it was built like a Baroque city. It's a very beautiful city, the new city, but it's not the old Arab city, which it used to be. So I decided to do this book on Sicily through the eyes of the great medieval, early medieval, middle medieval cartographer and geographer Idrisi, who made the first map of Europe. And what that produced was a very interesting thing for me, which was that the Arabs had been politically and militarily defeated. By Arabs, I mean not just the people who came from the Maghreb, but the army that they had built, which consisted largely of Sicilians who had converted, thanks, Sicilians who had converted to Islam. Palermo was predominantly a Muslim town. And so discovering this was quite fascinating as I was walking around Palermo, seeing the old street names and how they'd been distorted. And people would then take me into particular cafes. and say, eat the sweets in this cafe, familiar to you? And they certainly were. I could have been sitting in Damascus. So it was very interesting doing that, very educational for me, because I didn't know about it, so I learned. And I learned a lot about Idrisi, whose Universal Geography was a big reference work at the time. But the real interest was that though the Muslims in Sicily had been politically and militarily defeated, the culture was very strong, because Islamic civilization provided the culture of learning. So the Christians were in power, but the Norman rulers dressed in Arab clothes, Arabic was their main language, their children were educated by Arab tutors in mathematics, logic, grammar, astronomy, because that was the language of learning, Arabic. And this carried on for 150 years after the defeat, till the local crusaders and the Inquisition came into town. But what is also very interesting, that when the Pope sent an emissary to Roger I and Roger II, saying, we need Sicilian troops for the crusade, because we are trying to capture the Holy Lands back, Roger I refused to support the First Crusade and said, no, we don't. We don't agree with it. It's quite astonishing reading this stuff. He said, we don't agree with it. And he said, the bulk of my people are Muslims, and I'm not going to send them in an army to take lands which actually belong to them in other parts of the world. And it's when you discover things like this being done in the 12th century and the 13th century, you sort of, I did think at the time, I said, God, I wish Europe's politicians had the same guts in saying to the Americans, no, we're not going to invade Iraq, no, we're not going to invade Afghanistan, just because you tell us to. But he did it. And for the Second Crusade, his son told the Pope, in actually very rude language, the emissary of the Pope, to go and take a jump. I mean, it was ruder than that, but he said, no, we're not going to do it. No Sicilian troops will join the Christian crusade against the Arab world. And it was when I was completing a Sultan of Palermo that the war in Iraq started. And so the last, the characters in my book were escaping a massacre in Palermo and deciding to leave the island forever, some of the characters. And two of them had decided to go to Palestine. But another group was saying, we will go to Baghdad, which is the city of learning, where we have these public libraries, where we can carry out our research. And just as I was writing, that news came that Baghdad had fallen, and the new crusaders had taken that country. And so just automatically I remember typing out the last sentences, I will go to Baghdad, the city of learning, Baghdad, the city that will never fall, the city that will never fall, just at the time it had actually fallen. So I finished that, and then I had to, you know, constantly the work on this quintet kept being interrupted by world events. I mean, it was interrupted first by 9/11, and then I was under heavy pressure to write a book on these clashes and to reply to Samuel Huntington's thesis, Clash of Civilizations, which I did in a big book called Clash of Fundamentalisms. And then I got back to doing the fourth volume, Sultan of Palermo, and Iraq was occupied. So I had to sit down and write a book on the recolonization of Iraq, which took up a year and a half till that came out, and then go and sort of speak and defend that book and debate that book with various people, formerly Hemel Hempstead Maoists, all of them. So this last one took some time to come out, and it was a 20-year project, which is now over. And The Night of the Golden Butterfly, this was always my intention, to set the last novel in the present. And this is a novel essentially set in an imaginary country called Fatherland. But, you know, it isn't an imagined country at all. It's not even a particularly attempt to disguise it. It's Pakistan. And it is what is, you know, the people of that country, what has happened to them, what has changed. And then as I was writing it, you know, and when you're writing a novel, lots of things, it's totally different from writing fiction, because a lot of things you think you've completely forgotten actually begin to come out from within you. And I suddenly remembered a Chinese friend I used to have in Lahore, Chinese Punjabi, who spoke naturally. His family were born there, perfect Punjabi, etc. And I just began to remember conversations with him. And that gave me the idea also for introducing the Chinese in this case, Lahore, but actually they are all over India. And thinking, when did they come? That's a conversation I never had with my friend. When did your family come here? Because, you know, in those days, I just feel I have to say this. When we talked about identity, it was usually in relation to mathematics. We were never bothered as such about the ethnic identity of people, where they came from, or who they were. As long as you, and this was true all over India, but and not just India. So I remembered these conversations with my Chinese friend, and conversations in the purest of pure Lahore Punjabis. And I then said, God, now writing the novel, I wonder where he did come from. Why were they in Lahore? We never asked them. And then by a sort of, I just began to study the history. I went into the London Library to look at various books, and then saw a letter which the leader of a Chinese uprising in the middle of the 19th century had written to Queen Victoria asking for asylum in the British Empire against the Manchu repression which was taking place. And the letter had not been replied to, but I imagined that the local emissaries, the Brits in India, actually said, why not, come. I mean, you know, they know Chinese were quite good craftsmen, etc. And a lot of Chinese came at that time to Calcutta first, and then spread to the rest of the country. What made them do it? And then I had to go deep and dig into Chinese history, and I discovered this amazing uprising that had taken place in the province of Yunnan in the middle of the 19th century, virtually the same time as the uprising in India against the British, which was defeated rapidly. But the Manchus in Beijing, who were hated by most of the people because they were regarded as barbarians from Manchuria who'd done horrible things to the Chinese population further south, that this uprising lasted 9 years, that it was like a liberated zone. The Forbidden City was reconstructed in this beautiful Chinese town of Dali. And the leader of the uprising, a Chinese Muslim, Wu Denshu, took the name of Suleiman and issued fermans, orders in Arabic and in Chinese. All of them were in two languages. And the resistance was astonishing, absolutely astonishing. And it was incredibly advanced, the forms it took. And there was never any trace of religious fundamentalism or chauvinism. They fought because they were being massacred by the Manchus, and they organized, they armed themselves, they fought, and they won the support of local non-Muslims, and they worked together. And the big banners on the streets were unite. Muslims and non-Muslims unite against the Manchu oppression. And this took place roughly at the same time as the Taiping Rebellion. And then the Boxers came, but this socially was the most interesting. The Panthe Rebellion, as it's known. And so I made some of the characters in The Golden Butterfly refugees from that rebellion, which enabled me then for the characters to describe what happened through the eyes of stories and oral history told by grandmothers and great-grandmothers, which had been passed down to them. And interestingly enough, a few Chinese friends here who've read it said, we had absolutely no idea that this uprising, we know about the Boxers and the Taiping, but this, we had no idea that it was like this. And you know, when I write historical novels, I make it a point of honor never to fictionalize history. So the history in these novels is actually real. And it's around that history that I construct fairy tales and stories and weave plots. Because I believe that once you start fooling around with history, it's not fun anymore. For me, it isn't, you know. And many other historical novelists who write historical novels do the same. Some take liberties, but mostly people tend to be loyal to the history. So even in this novel, which is set in the 21st century, I make a historical detour through 19th century, mid-19th century China. It's just three chapters on it. And then that also provides a continuity with the first four novels, that here is a part of history which is hidden, forgotten, which is being recovered through a work of fiction. The main character in Night of the Golden Butterfly is the painter Plato, Muhammad Aflatun, which is Aflatun is the Arab name for Plato, and he is he's dying of cancer and desperately painting this triptych, which he thinks, because he thinks that works of art can affect the world, and he has arguments with the narrator and others who say works of art are great, but if you think they can change the world, you're making a mistake. Other things change the world. They can help by being there. But he says, no, I'm determined to leave behind this painting, which will completely, it'll be like a thunderbolt, which will completely change the fatherland. So I just want to read a tiny bit and then I'll stop. And what I'm going to read is the bit where the describe the painting. Yeah, three panels. The first panel was what Zainab had seen at an early stage. The horror had been her first reaction, and she had fled to Europe thinking that Plato was on the verge of insanity. The horror was undoubtedly present as the core of the painting, but it was much changed since those early drafts. This was the fatherland panel, the one he had told me might trigger an upheaval in the country. The cancers destroying it were painted as living organisms with tentacle-like attachments that were competing with each other to occupy the whole body. I'd never seen anything like this before, from Plato or anyone else. It was certainly original. The colors used to paint the cancers were strange combinations of blood red and pus yellow, but each was given individual features. Zainab wanted me to explain each section in turn, though Plato's message was clear enough. It may be tedious, but it's necessary, she had insisted the night before, in order for Alice Stepford to fully understand the complexity of the painting. This is a Western art critic who's there. Ali only knew the young Plato's work, which was not difficult to understand, not even the folio of 1964 etchings. So I complied, as I usually did, with Zainab's demands. The first panel, I said, could simply be titled The Four Cancers of Fatherland. These were lurid and surreal depictions. No subtleties, no mysteries to explain here. Plato loved leaving clues in his obscurer work, but had not bothered with any in this panel. The malignant cancer that had sprouted three siblings was shaped like an eagle. stars and stripes in a state of cancerous decay were tattooed on the back of an Uncle Sam like so many welts. The face of Uncle watching the eagle with an approving smile was unmistakable. It was Barack Hussein Obama, the first dark-skinned leader of the Great Society. The newest imperial chieftain was wearing a button. Yes, we can still destroy countries. Plato's image was designed to be crude, I thought, but was it accurate? Alice had become nervous and fidgety as she scribbled furiously in a notepad, a clear indication that the arrow had hit the mark. Was this the first critical entry by the art world? I could hear the sycophants hard at work, reassuring liberal opinion that Plato could be safely ignored. He was a marginal painter, not a celebrity with over 20 prizes to his name. I. M. Malik was a much greater and more important artist from that country, and was already working on a portrait depicting the president as St. George fighting an Islamist dragon breathing mushroom clouds. Commissioned by a private collector, it had already been booked into 7 museums on the strength of the idea and Malik's formidable reputation. But which painting would last? This is a question usually avoided by toadies, who can only live in and for the present so as never to be on the wrong side of history. Adept at sniffing power in every sphere which is part of their trade, they shift effortlessly from one posterior to another. Plato had nothing to fear from their judgment. The second cancer, painted in blood red and khaki, appeared to be saluting the first. Or was that my imagination? I moved back. I was right. He had not wasted too much time on Fatherland's army, and it painted the dictators it had given the country in garish colors. They were devouring bits of the dying country as if keeping the chemotherapy at bay. That must have been in Plato's mind, though not everyone present accepted my interpretation. Zythe thought it was far-fetched, but Alice and Zenob agreed. One of the despots was crumbling, and different bits of metastasizing material were floating in the air. The chemo had disintegrated at least one tumor. It was all a bit too much for me. The green bomb-shaped blobs with beards were the jihadis, shown in slow separation from the previous two and now developing a life of their own. But who were these 5 bloated figures with linked arms, all of them defecating gold coins, with each figure's outstretched hand cupped under his neighbor's buttocks, making sure that the enriched droppings fell on it until you got to the last figure, who was eating the gold shit with such vulgar abandon that his face was lathered with it? An odd nose, a typical display of teeth, a populist wave, identified this gang as poor Fatherland's much despised politicians. The colors used in this panel matched the intensity of the work. Looked at from a distance, it was stunning, but the closer one got to the painting, the more horrific it became. What gave this section real depth, however, was not so much the satire, which was obviously strong, but the wall of humanity with which the painter had encircled the canvas. Plato, the people on the edge were part hedge, part fence, men and women not unlike the 10 who had carried the painting into this hall an hour ago and were waiting patiently in the hot sun outside to take it back again. The people in the painting are also waiting. Why are they waiting? What are they thinking? Portraying them as a wall, Plato is stressing their strength. They are many, the cancers are few. What are they waiting for? For the intellect cancers to reach them? Each face reflects a different form of pain, resignation, anger, despair. I am reminded of Plato's very first work, the partition etchings, but this is different, for these people are not simply victims. Their passivity masks their strength. We may be poor, their faces appear to be saying, but our dreams are pure. There is no blood on our consciences. Perhaps there should be some. Did Plato feel that too during his last few days, as he fought against time to finish the painting? Just one more. That's the first panel. And there are three. This is the description of the second triptych. The other figures were also from the world of Islam, but of a very different time. Intellectual dissidents like the man who had painted them, and for that reason heroes who had thrilled his artist's blood. A blind poet is seated at the feet of the others. On his lap lies a famous work that was in fact the only parody ever done of Zainab's husband, and that too in the 12th century. Zainab, by the way, is a character in the novel who her family is married to the Quran. How we have progressed. The poet Abu Ala al-Ma'ari is conversing with fish and birds. Watching him with kindly, amused and protective expressions are three men in robes and turbans, each clinging to his own best-known work, as if someone were threatening to snatch it away from him. These three were old friends I had introduced to Plato 30 years ago, when he was in his most nihilist phase regarding the faith of his forebears. The great scholars of Al-Andalus in the Muslim world, Ibn Hazm, Ibn Sina, and Ibn Rushd. The last man, and I chuckled with delight, was the Sicilian geographer Muhammad Idrisi, showing them all his map of the world. I introduced these figures to the others, with Zainab nodding a bit too vigorously, as if she already knew, one of her few irritating habits, because she only did it when she was surprised but did not wish to admit the lack of knowledge. At first the single woman puzzled me. Who had Plato intended? Then I noticed that the uplifted arm had a sleeve with an Arabic inscription. Allah, I am fit for greatness and stride with great pride. I allow my lover to reach my cheek and I grant my kiss to he who craves it. But it was the hand that seemed odd. It had six fingers. Sixer. It was Valada, a 10th century poet in Cordoba, a woman who maintained a salon not far from the great mosque that was the site of many heated debates on art and literature, and where gossip carriers reported each day on the latest goings-on in the city. Sixer was the insult she had publicly hurled at her lover, a truly great poet, Ibn Zaydun, whose love poetry is taught to this day in Arab schools and universities. Zaydun had betrayed Walada's love by seducing her maid and subsequently moved on to young men. The poem she recited against him in public lacked literary merit, unlike her epic in defense of gossip, which only survives in fragments, but was repeated endlessly at the time for its shock value, and poor Ibn Zaydun became known in the city, indeed as far afield as Palermo and Baghdad, as the Sixer. They call you the Sixer. Your life will leave you before this name does. Sodomite and buggered you are, let's add adulterer, pimp, cuckold and thief. Now this is written in the 10th century by a Muslim woman poet in Cordoba. There were ruder epithets as well, but Sixer remained stuck to the poet till his enshrouded corpse was lured into the mud. This panel was obviously the good Muslim. I had realized my attention had been so concentrated on the main characters that I'd missed a few important details. It was Alice Stepford who made the discovery of the afternoon. What I had assumed was just a cloud turned out to be a man's face. Alice swore loudly that this was James Joyce and repeated the name with incredulity. We inspected the cloud from every distance, and seen from where she was standing, just a few feet from the painting, it was obvious she was right. There was also a number, and Zainab immediately understood. His first and last present to me was a well-worn edition of Ulysses. The Arabic numerals obviously refer to the page number. She finds the book. An excited Zainab had found the page and was going through each line. Then she found it and screamed, "It's Stephen Dedalus. He's just been reflecting on the mathematical discipline of the medieval Arabs and in particular algebra, and its symbols. He sees them, and she quotes, wearing quaint caps of squares and cubes, imps of fancy of the Moors, gone too from this world, Averroes ibn Rushd and Moses Maimonides ibn Maimun, dark men in mien and movement, flashing in their mocking mirrors the obscure soul of the world, a darkness shining in brightness which brightness could not comprehend. Thank you.
Well, that was great, as I promised you. Now, I'm sure a lot of people want to ask a lot of questions, please feel free to ask. Before I go any further, there are copies of the book on sale outside, and Tariq has agreed to sign them. So after this, you get it and come here, and he will sign the copies. Okay, now, who's going to ask the first question? Surely. Come on.
I think they're all desperate to buy books.
I will ask a question. Yes, yeah, please go ahead. Yeah.
Do you prefer writing about important things or everyday things?
It varies. In my fiction, I write about both. Quite a lot of the fiction very much deals with the everyday lives of the characters, you know, what they are, where, how they live, what they wear, what they eat, their love lives, their marriages, their breakups. I mean, there's a lot of that in there, but it's often disrupted by something that happens outside.
Sure.
And the effect that then has on these people. So in my fiction, both are there, but in my non-fiction, obviously, I write about, you know, what is important.
Mm. But can I ask you a question which sort of intrigues me? You know, here you are a Marxist, well-known Marxist, you know, atheist Marxist, long ago, and then you suddenly decide to write about Islam, and that's part of your heritage. At what stage did you believe that was an urgent task? I know you would not have done it otherwise.
I'll tell you what triggered it off, Meghnad. It was a remark on the BBC during the first Gulf War, made by a person I'm not going to name in public because he's now dead and gone.
Yes.
But a very intelligent guy who said, in order to justify the Gulf War, throwaway line, he said the Arabs are a people without a political culture. And a few other things. And that, for some reason, really angered me, because I said, this is not true. Mm. You know? This guy doesn't understand the history though he should have, because he was one of the experts. Anyway, so that just annoyed me, and I said, well, I'm going to go and read up a lot of this stuff in order to reply to this nonsense. Mm, mm, mm. And so I did this in the early 90s, and then by the time the fourth novel had come out, the whole world was buzzing with Islam because of 9/11, so that was fortuitous.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And I mean, I don't know whether people know, but more books have been published on Islam since 9/11 than the previous 600 years.
Ah, nice.
And a lot of them awful.
All of them equally. Yes. Yeah, over there.
You kind of winked and nodded at the reasons why, well, the fact that Israeli historians or novelists tend to want to forget or not kind of explore this kind of history and the Judaic Islamo history. Can you kind of go into some of the reasons why they still do it today, perhaps, or why they're willing to or unwilling to unravel the past of Judaism?
Why Israeli novelists do it? Well, some do and some don't. The ones who do it, interestingly enough, are the ones who are Arab Jews, Baghdadi Jews, or Jews from Damascus or Cairo who went to live in Israel after it was formed. Largely they were pressured to go. And they never really got over their own backgrounds and cultural past. I mean, they were great, you know, they were all over the Arab world. And in this country called Israel, where they now live, where its Arab citizens are treated like second-class citizens, these Jews from the Arab world remember the past, and they write about it, and it's very moving what they write. And that's why they do it, because the official culture in Israel, I mean, Israeli author has just sent Verso Books, of which I'm one of the directors, a non-fiction book. And it's this is a woman, Nurit Pellet. I don't mind saying her name because it's going to be a book published. Her son was killed by a suicide bomber. And she went publicly on Israeli television as they were trying to use her to launch an attack. She said, I don't want you to attack the Palestinians just because of my son. I will never get over his death. But I don't blame the Palestinians, I blame you for creating a situation in which they behave like this. That's how courageous she is. And she's just written a book called On What We Are Taught About Palestinians in Our School Textbooks, and it is horrific. Mm-hmm. It really is horrific. So they're very courageous Israelis who do this.
Yeah, deal with that, yeah.
Having listened to your speech, I get a feeling that the Arabs have been politically very mature people, but I can't see that in today's Arab politics. Why is that? Thank you.
Well, you know, mature may be the wrong word, but I know what you mean. It's because, you know, the period I am writing about is the peak of Arab civilization, Islamic Arab civilization, which was the main conduit of knowledge from antiquity to the European world. And a lot of the writers of the Renaissance, I mean, if you look at Dante's great work, one of the people he pays total homage to is Ibn Rushd, Averroes, as he was known in the Latin world, this Andalusian philosopher who wrote the first commentaries on Aristotle's texts and who actually wrote his own magnum opus, which was to explain to people at that time that there was a difference between divine truth and reason. Now, to produce this in the 12th century is quite an achievement. So, you know, there were people like that around. And also the Arabs were a ruling layer. They ruled, you know, they ruled by learning a lot. You have to understand the big difference between, by the time Constantine adopted Christianity had existed for a long time. And actually, it could be argued that becoming a state religion broke it, but that's another argument. But the Islamic rise was so swift that within 100 years of the Prophet's death, they were in China and the Atlantic. Combination of military advances and trade. The combination did it. And so they had to learn their stuff literally on the hoof. What are they going to do? And so when they, you know, took Persia, or later when they took the former Byzantine Empire, they assimilated a lot of the culture and education of that period, as the Mughals did when they took India. They never said you have to do everything we ask. They learned. And by doing this, they created civilizations that were mixed and had to be mixed, because there was no other way. And that is what made those civilizations very attractive. Why, I mean, look, it's a long thing. Why what has happened to the Arab world today is essentially as a result of the empires that were built in the 20th century. I mean, the Ottoman period was the last, if you like, golden period, in the sense that the Ottomans left them alone. So you had the Arab world was a world of large cities. You could be born in Amman, go to school in Jerusalem, go to university in Cairo or Damascus. And lots of people did that and recalled that. And that world was shattered. And then the Arab world was hit by all the storms and hurricanes of the 20th century. So you had Arab nationalism, typified by Nasser. You had Arab communist parties emerging. It's not that they remained isolated, but when they became completely stagnant, I would say is in the 70s and 80s, in a way a mirror for many of the things that are now happening in the West, by the way. A decline, a cultural political decline set in there after all the defeats that they had suffered. So one can't isolate it from it. That's one thing. And then the other thing is that the British Empire and the American Empire then tended to preserve the most reactionary, backward-looking, atavistic Arab rulers as their allies. That still is the case. Saudi Arabia.
And it's gone across to Pakistan.
And now it's exactly. and then they took it to Pakistan. So one can't totally look for psychological reasons within the Arab world for that. It's a result of what has happened. I'm not saying they don't make mistakes and horrible mistakes. They do. But it's not just that. One has to see it as a larger phenomenon.
Yes. That lady there, yeah.
Rabab Obeid, a student at SOAS.
Could you speak into the mic?
Oh, yes. I would like you to elaborate more a bit on the Arabs within the Ottoman Empire living during their last golden age. I mean, I'm a bit skeptical about. I know that it's an advantage living in Beirut and going and studying in Jerusalem and going to Baghdad. Definitely, this is required. But was it enough to say that this was a golden of the golden age? And what about modernity? Because later you have a book about why didn't the Ottomans modernize?
Yeah.
And the Arabs, from within the Ottoman Empire, couldn't modernize, and that's why they're lagging now?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. When I said the golden age, I meant in terms of the Arab nation being one nation. Right. That was not broken. And that was always an attempt by Arab leaders to try and reconstruct that nation. And it didn't happen. But on the failure of the Ottomans to modernize, I mean, there are many, many works written. And in my novel, The Stone Woman, it's a novel, but it touches on that because the family in this big house is decaying. And its decay mirrors the decay of the society outside, and already forces being influenced by French positivists and modernists are beginning to take shape. So, on that level it wasn't. I didn't mean by golden age that it was beautiful and all was well. That was not my meaning. I shouldn't have used it, possibly, but...
No. Yeah, 1 minute, because it's not going to be the podcast, so you got to put it in there, you see. Everything you say will be quoted against you.
I'm not used to this level of organisation. Thanks very much, Tariq, for coming, and I'm just going to try and come back on a question that was asked. And I suppose I should firstly say, again, thanks for writing a book on this topic, because what I think appears to be happening increasingly, or certainly, within a lot of the academic world and also a lot of people on the left, this idea of Marx on one side or left thinkers on one side and religion on the other. I think we need more books on this sort of stuff, really, that goes back to the true sort of basis and ideas of people on the left. I mean, I was speaking to someone recently who claimed to be on the left, and he was saying he was quite happy with the idea that people might go and smash a mosque up, or next to go and smash a church up, and then we'll go and smash the synagogue up. Crazy ultra left ideas. I think we have to revisit the tradition that Lenin really built in when he writes on minorities having the right to practice their religion in Russia, and he talks about in 1902 a good trade unionist fights for workers' rights, a good socialist fights against the pogroms for Jewish people. That's the kind of tradition that we need to try and build upon, really. And I just wondered really if how Tariq thinks we might be able to overcome the boundaries that there are within the academic world, who often will sort of casually say is religion and left-wing thinking don't go hand in hand, and you know, yeah, how we can overcome them boundaries, really.
Well, there are people who talk like that. Mercifully, there are not too many of them, actually. There are other problems we have, which is that since 9/11, there has been a huge wave of Islamophobia sweeping the Western world. And that is much more of a problem than the odd book by a, you know, sort of uninformed academic. And in and it's this Islamophobia which does concern me, because apart from anything else, it's based on ignorance. But more importantly, that gets official or semi-official encouragement in the debates that are taking place, for instance, in France and Belgium on the niqab and the hijab and all that. And my position on all that is very straightforward. I'm opposed to the state, any state, interfering in how women dress.
Absolutely.
Or men.
Or men.
Yeah. Or, you know, whoever. Because all my life I've been arguing against the Saudis and the Iranians forcing women to put on the hijab. And I still do. So if that is your position, then you can't be against one state doing that and another state doing the exact opposite, saying you can't wear it. I'm not in favor of that. And so these are issues which should be taken up more vigorously in civil society and public debates, because they are important issues. You know, they are sort of tiny scratches which, if not dealt with immediately, gangrene can develop.
You know, let me just supplement this. You know, when I went to Berkeley in the early 60s, hippies suddenly came.
Yeah.
And terrible, they had long hair. They didn't wear shoes, you know, they didn't wear clean clothes, they were dirty. And then there came the generation who completely shaved their heads off. And that's terrible, you know, they're kind of, you know, they're dangerous. And then hoodies are dangerous because, you know, the kids who wear hoodies, you know. You know, and you say, you know, why don't you leave people alone? Here is a civilization which claims to believe in individualism, believe in choice, believe in consumer freedom. Why don't you leave people alone? I mean, how come a culture which prides itself on enlightenment and modernity can go around banning niqab? For God's sake. You know, what would it look like if somebody banned the bikini or something? For God's sake, you know. I mean, there are people who probably would want like to, but I would be as much against banning a bikini as I'm against, you know, banning a niqab. You know, leave people alone, let them do what they like to do, and it's nobody else's right to say, what should be done. Anyway, I could also go on, but Can I give one footnote to you to read? Gareth Stedman Jones's edition of Communist Manifesto. Gareth Stedman Jones. His edition, he explains why religion was the starting point of Marx's critique of philosophy. And how religion was extremely important. And I think until the First World War, you saw these people like Russell and so on. They knew their Bible backwards. They could quote it, you know. Marx quotes the Bible again and again. And the idea that somehow being progressive or left-wing or even being an atheist means to be ignorant of religion.
It's
or contemptuous.
Crazy.
That's stupid. That is stupidity. That is non-modernity. That is just stupidity. Somebody wants this question. That lady there.
Thank you so much. I'm new to your work, and so I was curious about why you chose the fatherland to be Pakistan over other
places.
Could
you speak into the mic?
Yeah, I was wondering why you chose the fatherland to be Pakistan versus other places.
Why I showed Pakistan as fatherland?
Correct.
I don't know, because when I started writing the novel, I just thought, write Pakistan. It's pretty obvious what the country is. So it sounded better in a literary sense to call it fatherland and to refer to the people as fatherlandies. rather than Pakistanis. But and Islamabad I refer to as Islu, which lots of Pakistanis do as well.
Yes, absolutely. There's a film called Slakistan, which I saw recently, in which the young people drifting around Islamabad refer to as Islu.
Yeah, there are many ruder names as well. But so, you know, I know that I go to the country a lot, visit it a lot. That's the only reason.
And you know, sorry, Tariq has, I did mention, Tariq has been monitoring what's happened in Pakistan very thoroughly over the last 50 years.
Yeah, there are three other books in which it's mentioned on every page.
Yeah, over there.
I was most interested in what you were saying about...
Can you hold it to your mouth, yeah?
Hold it right here. I was most interested in what you were saying about your relationship with your Bengali Chinese friend, how, if I understood you correctly, in your interaction there was really no awareness, certainly wasn't important, the fact that he was Chinese and you were something else. And I was just wondering whether that experience might... offer a cat flap through, so to speak, a much more significant revealing truth that lies generally unacknowledged in relation to what's happening in the world right now, and the circumstances that truly applied in the not too distant past, in contrast to the, I feel, very anachronistic way in which the generality of academics who should know better back project the notion A, of nationalism, and B, religion. There was a book, largely forgotten, written by an Episcopalian in the early 60s that caused a real kerfuffle amongst comparative religionists. He was the professor of comparative religion at Harvard, and it was a book called The Rise and Meaning of Religion. And he argued, in my view most convincingly, that religion, contrary to what's generally supposed, is in fact a very recent and a peculiarly European construct. Nationalism, we know, doesn't really predate in any real serious sense the 19th century. And I was surprised, amazed. I bought it thinking it was a travel book. It came out only last year, titled The Discovery of France. A better title, really, would have been The Invention of France. The fact that even France, as recently as into the 20th century, there were people who did not regard themselves as French. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little more about the extent to which those two concepts are used to give sinew to give muscle to the means whereby ideologically the minority who control the bulk of the wealth and the power globally use it to further strengthen their position. Final footnote, maybe in defense of the academic to whom you referred, and I may be wrong, but I think I can guess it was somebody not somebody occupying a seat not a million miles away from this building, that maybe the reason why he said the Arabs have no political sense, I can't remember, maybe I misquote, but maybe what he was alluding to was the fact that yes, in the Arab world outside Europe, really, there's always been an atavistic response to the other, that the notion of the nation state really didn't exist. There is no word in Arabic that corresponds really. The notion of Islamic State is really balderdash. Ummah really means community. So I'd just be very grateful, Tariq, if you could forgive me for droning on, but maybe just expatiate a bit more on these issues.
Well, you've really expatiated yourself quite a lot, so... I have nothing more to add. I mean, it's true that the nation state is a relatively modern construct. So is communism, and there are words for communism in Arabic, ishtrakiyat, which is used, and the word for socialist is usually the same, or it's referred to as socialist. So it's not that these ideas didn't get there; they did get there. And they were very popular, I mean, and were popularized a great deal because you had large, huge currents, which were currents that called themselves Arab nationalist currents. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, you know, all in the past now, because now we have a big clash between neoliberal governments backed by the United States and moderate or more extreme religious groups. So the big vacuum has been created by the disappearance of these currents. It's quite interesting, if I can make a sort of footnote remark, that whenever I speak in Britain on literature or my fiction, it ends up like this. We end up discussing everything else under the sun, which is fine, I'm not complaining. But this never happens in France or Germany, or I've just returned from all the old Yugoslav cities, Sarajevo, where my novels are published, and where people discuss literature for 2 to 3 hours. Or Spain, by the way, but anyway. Well, I think because this is a country where I've lived most of my life now, yeah, and I'm known, as Meghnad was telling you, for what I am, you know, left-wing socialist, which I've been and will probably remain for the rest of my life. And so I don't blame people for that, but it's always like that.
Now, it always happens, more questions come from the end than beginning. I don't have very much time because LSE is a crowded place. But I'm going to take that person there, the woman there, and then the man there, and then we will think. Yeah.
I think you're being told to finish, aren't you? Okay.
No, no, this is a conversation about what's happening in politics.
So I think you want to get someone else, but sorry. Just a last point about literature. I was just wondering about the form of a kind of historical novel, really, and do you feel, and you've just completed this quintet, do you feel like there's another historical novel in you? How have you found writing as you've progressed? Have you found enjoying it, or are you going to write another quintet?
Yeah, this quintet was a special project which I finished. I am thinking of I have one or two other ideas, not part of this, but fiction, because I've written. I mean, I wrote a novel on the fall of communism called Fear of Mirrors, which I wrote in 1993, but which people didn't want to publish till six years later, because they said we're still too raw. So that was published in 1998, and it's Fear of Mirrors, and in it's being reprinted now as a hardback by Seagull, an Indian publishing house, so it'll be available again, but it's published all over. Funnily enough, the countries where it was most popular were the Arab world and Turkey, where they felt they were missing something. So I do have other projects, and I don't like talking about them till they're done, but yeah.
Okay, the lady there, and then the gentleman behind her. Keep it short.
You mentioned your book, The Clash of Fundamentalisms, that you wrote as a response to Huntington's clash
of... Would you speak into the mic, yeah.
That you wrote as a response to Huntington's clash of civilization. I was wondering, what was the response to your book, particularly from the academia?
It wasn't a single response. It was actually, you know, some... within the academy, lots of people liked it. It's on lots of course lists in the United States, which is why it keeps being reprinted. And here, in fact, at the University of East Anglia, the politics department has a whole course called Clash of Fundamentalisms, which I didn't know till I went there recently. So it's, you know, obviously some people agreed, some didn't agree, some disliked it, some liked it, but there was no blanket attempt to, you know, stop it being circulated or anything like that. It was, by and large, it was positive, actually, it has to be said.
The gentleman there.
As you just mentioned earlier, that to discussions tend to get digressed slowly, and I think my question is not going to be an exception to that fact. Just picking on an earlier reference of, and just the lady before asked about class of civilization and rise of fundamentalism, I haven't read your book, so excuse my ignorance, but I have a feeling that there's sort of in the modern world, so to speak, particularly after 9/11 and things that has happened, you know, London bombing and Bombay bombing and all that sort of thing, people are sort of going back to their religious sort of identity as if they are suffering from some sort of identity crisis, which is leading to the rise of fundamentalism. Do you think this is the case, that people are slowly looking back into their sort of, you know, their religious text, and people thinking that they need to find a tradition in their religion, and there's a sort of a conscious effort to go back to their sort of the history, as if they were suffering from some sort of an identity crisis? And if you think that is the case, then why do you think people are suffering a new wave of crisis?
Because I think that what has been happening in the world for the last 20 years, after the collapse of communism, you know, turbo-propelled capitalism, called neoliberalism, which is now reaching the end of that phase, created big vacuums. You know, first it made people think that they were powerless. There was nothing else they could do. Secondly, they were supported by center-right and center-left parties all over the world. So in countries where there was no resistance to them, South America is a very exceptional continent from that point of view, because you did have giant movements against privatization and deregulation, and many of them won. But in large parts of the world, people felt that there was a vacuum and a gap in their lives, and so you had what I would just call an increase in religiosity. And not all of this was political, by the way. There was just a desire to do something. And many young people who in the 60s and 70s would have joined far left groups or radical groups now went in that direction because they didn't see anything else. It became partially also a question of identity. But having said that, I really would like to stress that one must always avoid thinking in stereotypes. Islam, it's a huge bloody religion. You know, which stretches from China to the African coast. It's the same? No. Which is the largest Muslim country in the world? Indonesia, with an incredibly syncretic culture. But when people talk about Islam, they essentially think about the Arab world. Why? Because that's where the oil is. And they think also that this is what is representative of Islam, and it really isn't. And it's a very, you know, there are lots, all the colors of the rainbow are contained within Islam, politically, socially, culturally. And the same goes for every other religion. Some are extreme right-wing within all religions. And the Republican Party, you know, you feel has virtually been taken over by Christian fundamentalists in the United States. In fact, if I were to make a rough guess, I would say probably there is more religious fervor in the United States, not just than in Europe, but than in most other parts of the world. But I mean a deep-seated religious fervor. All these statistics and opinion polls show that. So, you know, that's something which one has to deal with.
Lovely. Listen, I'm going to have to conclude this thing, but I want to tell just one story about the variety of Islam. In India, there was this famous mosque destroyed in 1992, 6th of December 1992. And one of the groups which went to destroy it went to a very famous Muslim saint's site in Ajmer called Moidun Chishti Dargah. And they asked for blessings from Moidun Chishti Dargah because they were going to go out to destroy a mosque. Now, you know, when that happens, you say, what's going on here? You know, these people who want to destroy a mosque deeply believe that this saint is going to bless them.
Bless them.
Wow. You know, okay. Very Catholic note, if I may say so. May I thank Tariq immensely, because I haven't had such pleasure for a long time, because I have not been in the same room as him. But you have all been lucky, and so go out and buy the book, and go out and buy all the other books, because all that the authors want is people to buy their books.
And read them.
Yeah, that's because he's like that.